Welcome to Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. We are pretty damn excited. This is our 50th show. Chris Haig, how are you, sir?
I am very well. I am very excited. In fact, it's our 50th episode. It's quite a milestone.
That's weird, right? Like it just feels like yesterday that we started. But no, this is 50 shows.
Oh,
and
my God.
it's been so much work. That Brandon's like, guys, I can't even do it. We gave him the day off.
I think Brandon's enjoying the, we're like, fit, because, I mean, I guess if we were to work it back and do all of our bonus episodes and kind of the extra bits and pieces that we do for all our lovely listeners, it probably isn't 50, it's probably somewhere in, like, the upper 50s into the 60s, but it's our 50th proper episode, and I think Brandon was like, I love you guys, but I need, Just a break.
I needed a day off.
Totally fine. He needed the day off to celebrate.
So. I've trained you well, young Jedis. You can run the show for the day.
Exactly.
He gave us the keys to the studio and left the fridge unlocked.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is going to be an exciting episode because what we're doing today is, in a bit, we're going to talk about a new book called The Camera Lies, which is about Hitchcock films. And later on, we're going to be joined by our good friend Manish Mathur, and we're going to be talking about the two different Rebecca films. So that's going to be very, very interesting. And to start things off, we have a hard media report. We have no budget for actual sound effects. So this is a poster. It's a movie poster, but it's not a theatrically released one. This is a bit of, what would you call it, fan art by Robert Zavala out of Texas. And if you're interested, check out robertzavala.net. So he has a thing it's a beautiful 30-inch paper poster, and it's on a nice heavy card. It's a very professionally printed piece, and it's his interpretation of what is sitting in the swamp behind Bates Motel, and it's quite something to look at. There's a companion piece, so there's actually two posters. One is the everything in the swamp, and one is like an infographic with little trivia and pieces of information about the movie. So both of these would be very appropriate for the Hitchcock fan. You might even consider this as a gift coming up for Christmas if you have time to order one. But Chris, you've had a chance to look at these images.
What do you
think of everything that is under the water? Like, this is quite an interesting image to look at.
I know. I mean, I think first of all, it's absolutely gorgeous. The amount of kind of attention and detail that's been put into the poster, but the infographic as well is absolutely fantastic. And I think it's commendable on its own respect there, but I do love the fact that it addresses the events of the film, but then also has some fun with stuff. So it's kind of like, oh, what else is under the swamp? Here's this, here's that, maybe this is there, maybe that's there. So I think it is something really, if you are a Hitchcock fan and if you really love Psycho, I think it'd be something that is not only gorgeous to look at, but it's also a really interesting conversational piece, and it's really funny as well. So,
and it's true to the story of the film that there is talk of other women having been buried in swamp, other victims of Norman.
At the end of the film, he says, oh, there's at least a couple of girls who've gone missing. And it's, you know, it is implied that they are going to drain the swamp, so who knows what they find. That in itself would be an interesting sort of offshoot avenue for him to have gone down. So I think really fun that they've done it in poster form.
And the poster itself shows the actual car with Marion in the trunk with the legit license plate and everything, half through the water, and then various things under the water like newspapers and skulls, and there's a little silhouette of Hitchcock. There's a can of the chocolate syrup that they were using in the shower scene. There's all these little cute little references that the inside fans will understand. And then when you look at the info poster, like, the artwork is really nicely done. And this is a what is it? Like a classic 50s cartoon style? It's sort of a black and like a black and white sepia tone. The artwork is really nicely done. And Robert explains on here, he has pictures of Saul Bass, the designer, composer, Bernard Ehrman, the writer, Robert Bloch, and another picture of Hitchcock, and some stories about the Christine car from the Stephen King book. And, like, a lot of interesting things that are related to the film and related to the poster itself. So there's more, definitely a lot of added content.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, It's not just because there are some brilliant people out there doing these gorgeous interpretations of the Psycho posters or Hitchcock posters in general, but it's not just that. You are getting fun bits of trivia and kind of little Easter eggs and movie references that aren't Hitchcock films, but they tie in that same kind of pop culture way. I think it's absolutely gorgeous. And again, like you said, with the license plate and with all the little attention to detail, you can tell it's a real labor of love. And I think it's just, it's well worth a look.
What Robert talks about is that he wanted to put a virtual camera in a position that could see above and below the waterline in the swamp. He wanted to see the reverse view of Norman Bates. So from the water, looking back onto the shore as Norman stands there watching the car sink, which is such a dramatic moment in the film, because the car goes and it kind of stops, and then he's like, "What? Why isn't it moving?" And then the car keeps moving. He wanted
starts to bubble, and
he showed everything under the water, and he realized that we were never really told in the film where the swamp was relating to the Bates Motel, so he kind of took some liberty in placing it where he did. Now, Brandon also, of course, had a chance to look at this, and he really appreciates it. Like, if you've ever seen Brandon's basement, he's got so much poster art everywhere. So I'm sure this will be an added gem on his wall. But the one he really liked, if you go to the robertzavala.net, there's a number of posters from a number of different movies. There's a really interesting one, The Batman, the Orson Welles connection. Like, they go there and browse through these and have a look. I definitely appreciate the talent that and the skill that Robert puts into this work. So now, because we love our listeners and they're so wonderful to us, we're going to do something special. So we're giving away one of these posters, and what you can do if you want a chance to win is the prize will be one of the swamp posters signed by Robert Zavala. So give us an email. Drop us an email at goodeveningpodcast@hotmail.com. If we get your email before December 31st of 2020, we're going to draw a winner randomly, and Robert will send the poster out to you. But we're going to have to limit this to anywhere in the USA or Canada, just for the shipping purposes. It's much simpler. And like I said, check out robertzavala.net, his website, for this poster and all his other work and information on how to order them. So Robert Zavala, Zavala. So that is the website. Check that out. And thank you for Robert for participating and getting involved with our show. And good luck to you with those sales of that poster. I think the fans that get a hold of that will really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, so Chris, I think they'll love it.
Chris, I know not only you're a big movie fan, but you're a very, very avid reader. I'm jealous of your ability to read at great speed. And a lot of times on our show, we take advantage of all the books that exist about Hitchcock, and we refer to them. So I'm always happy to have a new resource and a new piece to read from to help us learn more about the great work of Hitchcock. So what we have is a brand new book. It's just hit the market from Oxford University Press. Dan Callahan is the author. The Camera Lies, Acting for Hitchcock. And Chris and I have both taken the time to read this. And I think, if you don't mind, I'm just going to do some of my thoughts off the top here.
Yeah, go for it.
It's valuable for the viewers to have a book like this, the fans of Hitchcock, because the real purpose of a book like this is to allow the reader a way to go more in-depth into the Hitchcock films after watching them. So Callahan writes a fast-moving book packed with lots of information, inside stories, and behind-the-scenes information on the production of Hitchcock's films. A lot of this comes, I'm sure, from the many sources he has listed in the biography. The many volumes of work that are available on the subject of Hitchcock are a blessing to a project like the book by Callahan. So his own understanding of the art of acting really shows through, and he proves his knowledge of the films with very refreshing summaries. You can tell he knows these films very well and has given each one the time and attention it deserves. He avoids the typical encyclopedic format and goes into the films in chapters and groups of films of six, maybe as few as two per chapter. And he keeps the chronology in place, but knows when to expand on the more important films. And he's very open to talk about Hitchcock's relationships with the actors, his treatment of them, the conflicts, and the successes. And I think this is important, that in a time of film fandom, where so many quotes by great directors are minced down into untrustworthy memes that bounce around the internet with no validity or foundation, Callahan backs up the golden quotes and gives them worth. So Hitchcock's tendency to shoot a love scene as if it were a murder, and to shoot a murder as a scene of love, it's presented in context after discussion of how the Hitchcock films show seduction and destruction, feeling it like the same thing. So it's an interesting book, and it has a lot of knowledge to be gained from reading it. Chris, what was your initial reaction when you started to read the book?
So I really enjoyed it because it is very encyclopedic and holistic, and it covers the whole of Hitchcock in a way that, you know, we're doing it in a chronological format and we're trying to cover everything and all that. So I really appreciated it for that. If you are a Hitchcock fan already, I think you would really enjoy this because it provides so much information and it provides so much, so many resources and tidbits and stories. As someone who comes from a vague academic background, if I see a massive bibliography, that makes me quite happy because it means they've actually backed up their quotes and theories and all the things they're actually talking about, which means it's well researched and people have spent a lot of time working on this and making sure it's the best it can be. So this makes me really happy. I enjoyed the fact that we got it wasn't just like, oh well, this film was forgotten here or this film didn't get enough. Every film in the kind of Hitch canon got a decent shot and it got some interesting backstory, even for films where, you know, I'd seen them a dozen times. There was really interesting information. There was really kind of fascinating facts and anecdotes that I wasn't even aware of. So, for example, I'm a big Audrey Hepburn fan. Right. I had no idea. And I had to write this down in my little notes section saying, you know, a page somewhere in the 200s, it says, Audrey Hepburn dropped out of a Hitch film. He wanted to do a film with her, that sort of thing. But then when she found out that part of her story would be she'd be dragged into Hyde Park in London and nearly raped, she dropped out of it. And to be honest, good for her, because that sounds quite horrific to film. But it's stuff like that. It's all these information kind of tidbits and stuff that you, the connections that you might not have seen or might not have made up, that goes in with a really well-researched project. So, for example, in the past year, I've read two separate sort of essay books or collection of essays about Rear Window. One of them was fantastic, five stars, and it, different essays, and it really backs it up and that sort of thing. And then the second one, which I'm not going to name, got one of the main characters' names, didn't get it wrong, refused to call them by their name.
Wow.
They were well, in fact, I'll tell you. So in Rear Window, the character of Stella, a.k.a. a very big character in the thing, is only ever called the nurse.
Right.
And for some reason, that really got under my skin. So even that's reflected in The Camera Lies, because it really has a focus on side characters and these kind of one-scene characters and these fantastic actors who, you know, made such a notable impact. So, you know, the next one coming up after this is going to be Stage Fright, and he spends a lot of time talking about the incredible Joyce Grenfell, who, unfortunately, I don't think is very widely known outside of the UK, but she was a fantastic comedic actress and was very much a sort of... I think the term I'm thinking of is sort of like a character actress, or she did very specific studied pieces, so she's fantastic. He spends a lot of time talking about the character of Louise in Shadow of a Doubt, for example, as this kind of dark mirror to Charlie. You know, I do love the expression that goes into each film, and sometimes that's the form of, here's what happened during production, or here's what certain characters could be. So it is all different. You aren't getting, like, the same rote list every time. And I do enjoy that sometimes you don't know what he's going to be talking about. So say, you know, Topaz and what they discuss is going to be different from Marnie, or it's going to be different to Shadow of a Doubt or Lifeboat, or, you know, any of that kind of stuff. And it's interesting in that it doesn't, it's quite, I won't say sympathetic to Hitch, but it does make him more well-rounded. So it neither makes him out to be sort of this infallible genius, nor this monster. It does try and balance it out, and I think that's quite a fair and is a really decent way of exploring, you know, a film creator who wasn't perfect, was really temperamental, but then equally, you know, there's an anecdote about the kindness he showed Anthony Perkins, which for such a cantankerous man, I think he's quite sweet. You know, and it's also, I will say, there are some moments in the book that truly made me cackle. So, and I'll give people a page number, just so if you buy it, which I recommend you do, it's a great book. But I would recommend that page 102, it's about, appropriately enough, it's about Rebecca, and it says, "Oh, Mrs. Danvers, topping from the bottom."
Yeah, I read that today.
I promise you, because it's a digital copy, I put my laptop down because I was scared I was going to drop it because I was laughing so much. Because that's a genius. It was really funny. And there are little bits like that scattered throughout. So I think it's the rare sort of text where you can view it in an academic light and go, yep, this is absolutely fine. But it's not dry and it's not stuffy. And it does have humour and it does... play with stuff, and it does kind of go, oh, okay, well, what if this was the case? I really enjoyed The Camera Lies. I think as a primer for Hitchcock, I would say maybe watch films before reading this, because it does not, I mean, I won't say spoil, but it does go into detail about the details.
It gives the information. Yeah, it tells you what happened.
Yeah, exactly.
I think of it almost like, you know how much Hitchcock loves a train traveling with great energy and, you know, through the wilderness and through the darkness of the night and bringing evil into small towns. Anyway, this book has a tempo. Like, it goes. It just kind of go, go, go. Like, he doesn't really dwell, and it doesn't get boring, and it just makes you want to just keep reading. Like, it keeps pulling you along. And again, I'll admit, like, I'm a film fan. I'm not a big reader, but I really got through this. I really enjoyed reading this. I really had a good time. And he said, there's so many little gems. With the subtitle, you know, he's talking about The Camera Lies, and he really is talking about acting for Hitchcock. And Dan himself is quite an experienced actor. I'll just, his quick bio here. He's the author of Barbara Stanwyck, The Miracle Woman, Vanessa, The Life of Vanessa Redgrave, The Art of American Screen Acting from 1912 to 1960, and a sequel to that book. And he's written for Sight and Sound, Film Comment, Nylon, The Village Voice, many other publications. So Dan has got a lot of experience, but he has an interesting... He's talking about the camera lies, and when you're reading, you'll find a dozen spots in the book where that phrase comes up and gets a bit more exposure, explanation. Here's a... I'm going to read you a paragraph from page 143. Ingmar Bergman used glycerin rather than actually crying in movies like Casablanca, and clearly this jewel tear is glycerin rather than an actual tear. An actual tear would never have stayed as round and clingy as the glycerin tear on the bottom of her left eye. The camera lies, but the lies it tells are so much more beautiful and more expressive than the truth of the real tears and mucus and so forth. Bergman's face in close-up with this glycerin tear is an emblem for acting in Hollywood, in Hitchcock's films. It's not real, but it has style, and it's better than real life. So that's a very, very good explanation of the reasoning behind why things are done the way they're done on film, right? So, yeah. Like a lot of the book, and you know, I appreciate all the different resource books that we refer to. They all have their strengths. But this one does avoid the cliche, like you said, the cliche encyclopedic and, you know, formatted commentary on the films. And it, like you said, it has a nice mix of the explanation of the film, the explanation of the casting and what was going on, the relationships between Hitchcock and his actors, and the power struggles and the real Hollywood backdrops. And you know, like we were both saying, it's, I think it's a good reference point for film fans and Hitchcock fans to get a copy of this book and enjoy it. And like you said, try and maybe watch the movies ahead of time if you haven't or if you can, but just keep that in mind that it'll be a really good companion to having watched the films.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, if somehow we've managed to convince you to check the book out, that is one thing I would say is see the films, let you have your own experience of watching them and all that sort of thing. Not because this book will unduly influence you one way or the other, but because you get that pure first experience, and then, say, if you look at The Camera Lies or any of the other Hitchcock texts that we use throughout the show, they can colour or shade or change the way you view certain things in certain films or elements of films or that sort of thing. But it is very well written in the sense of there's a narrative structure that runs throughout, and these whole beats of, oh, well, the camera, you know, the camera lies, and it's all about kind of the artifice of film and how to produce... It's a bit, you know, if you could make an actor cry on film rather than a glycerin tear, is that more real or less real?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know,
if it comes from a genuine emotion, is that real? Because but it's still fake because it's in a film that's fictional or a different character. So, and there are those moments sprinkled throughout, like Tom says. And I just think it's a really interesting way of viewing the Hitchcock canon, particularly as someone who, you know, he's famously would do horrible things to pull performances out of actors. So, you know, he would show people in coffins or use real birds to attack people or, you know, make slaps real or, you know, just to elicit that genuine reaction. But then is it genuine in that context? And it is something that Dan really does explore in the book, and I think it's well worth the price of admission for me, because it's comprehensive and it's doing it without being stuffy, and it covers everything. It's not just focusing on, say, the big Hollywood films or the more obscure ones. It really does comprehensively break it all down, and it ends without spoiling anything. It ends on quite an interesting note that I didn't see coming.
Right.
I thought was quite it's an interesting way, and it does tie things up theme wise. So
So once again, this new book, hot off the press, Dan Callahan is the author. The Camera Lies, Acting for Hitchcock, available from Oxford University Press, wherever you happen to buy your books. I'm sure it's available. And this, again, is our 50th episode. We're having a very busy show, lots of stuff going on. Chris and I will be back in a moment with our special guest. We are back on Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock podcast, episode 50. Chris Hagen and I are very excited to welcome to the show, all the way from New York City, Manish Mathur. Manish, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me, and congratulations on 50 episodes. It's quite an achievement.
Oh, we're excited, right? We were talking, like, we started 2017, and we've had so many great guests like yourself on over the years, and 50 episodes, it sounds great. Like I was gonna
make the joke that it's like it's 50 episodes, but we look like it's 25. It looks really good.
That's funny. So Manish, you were on Talk Film Society, and tell us a bit about any other of your film-related projects, and tell us a bit, if you can, about... You did a series, The Beginner's Guide to Hitchcock. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so I have been writing and working with Talk Film Society for about almost 4 years now. Crazy, yeah. And for about 2 years, I wrote a column for them called The Beginner's Guide to Alfred Hitchcock, where I went through 52 of his surviving completed feature films, starting from the 1920s into his last film in the 70s. And it was quite an experience. It was a lot of fun, and some tedious films to watch. And that wrapped, I think, about in 2019. Since then, I've been working with them on two podcasts. One is It Pod to Be You, which I host, and I invite guests to talk about romance film, romantic comedies, romantic dramas, you know, just anything related to that genre. And also, I co-host a podcast with Dave Giannini called Queer Now, where we go through each decade and talk about a queer film from every year in that decade. So we completed the 2010s a little while ago, and we have skipped back to the 1930s, so we're in the middle of the 30s. And you know, there's a lot of queer cinema out there in, from that old Hollywood era, even if you have kind of to like squint and try to find the queerness there. But you know, there is some queerness in those movies. Sometimes it's just a character. Sometimes it's kind of a minor plot point. Sometimes it's just the filmmaker, you know, themselves being queer. So, and, you know, Rebecca, the 1940 film, I believe, I'm not sure if we're going to talk about it. I think it's on our list of potential movies because it's like semi-queer. But we're very excited, so hope you know, listeners are interested in those shows. Hope you check it out. And thanks again for having me. I'm very excited to be back. I love chatting with you guys.
Well, no, it's great to have you. And I think Farmer's Wife was one of the earliest episodes that we did that you were on.
Yeah, Farmer's Wife, and then I came on for Rebecca about, I think, earlier this year.
Yeah, and I'll be honest, like, I can't, you know, we kind of do what we can. Like we were saying, Chris and I had to give Brandon the day off today. He just knew that Chris and I would be happy to roll through this episode, and he took the Sunday off to be with his kids and put up some Christmas trees at his house. But I hadn't seen either Rebecca film, and I didn't participate in that episode. So last night, I was listening to your episode of our show in preparation for today's show. So it's all wrapping around, right?
Yeah.
And like I said, I hadn't seen either film before. But before we get too far into this, Chris, if you could go ahead and just give us the summaries of the two films.
Absolutely. So This is for both films. It's taken from the 1940 synopsis, but believe me, it covers both films. So Rebecca, which is an both of which are adaptations from the novel by Daphne du Maurier, is the story of a young woman who marries a fascinating widower, only to find out that she must live in the shadow of his former wife, Rebecca, who died mysteriously several years earlier. The young, unnamed wife must come to grips with the terrible secret of her handsome, cold husband. She must also deal with the jealous-obsessed Mrs. Danvers, the housekeeper of Manderley, who will not accept her as the mistress of the house. So yeah, we're doing a compare and contrast to the 1940 version. I'll just give you a couple of insights. The 1940 version, the role of the second Mrs. De Winter was played by Joan Fontaine. The role of Max De Winter was played by Laurence Olivier. And the role of Mrs. Danvers was played by Judith Anderson. In the 2020 version, the role of the second Mrs. De Winter was played by Lily James. Max De Winter in the 2020 version was played by Arnie Hammer. And then Mrs. Danvers in the 2020 version was played by Kristin Scott Thomas.
Right on. And who is our director? It's a British production, the 2020?
Yes. So the 2020 is directed by a director called Ben Wheatley, who people might know from films such as High Rise. He did... I'm really trying to remember what it was called, but there was a fantastic... I think Kill List was his first film. He did High Rise... he also did a movie, I'm trying to think, Brie Larson, called Free Fire, that was absolutely fantastic. He's also done some dark comedies as well, so it's an interesting one. Without going too much into it, it's an interesting one for him to choose as a project.
And I'm thrilled. Like, I know the new Rebecca isn't a Hitchcock. This is one of our tangents that we allow ourselves, where we're talking about a film, which is a revisiting of an old Hitchcock film, which is based on a book by Daphne du Maurier. And what this allows is for us to not only review a film that's literally in the theaters on air, like it's on Netflix right now, which is the new theater. And this is a hot topic. Like, everybody's talking about it. I know lots of my film fan friends at work and that are talking about the film. And in a good way, this is a gateway film to get new viewers interested in Hitchcock, because hopefully they'll see this version and go, hey, I wonder what the old version's like, and, you know, get involved in the Hitchcock, you know, canon, as it were. So I'm very excited that there's this modern adaptation. And like I said, I watched the two films, both for the first time in the last 24 hours. Chris, what's your history of watching the two films?
So I've got a bit of history of Rebecca in the sense of it was something I studied as part of my A-level studies in the UK. I watched the 1940 version years ago, and then I rewatched it for when we recorded the episode. I think Manish was right, probably a few months ago now. Oh, I'm so bad at dates. And then the new version, because I'll be honest, I've been working from home, I put it on the background when I was working when it first aired, because I was like, oh cool, let's see what this is like. So yeah, I got to kind of literally compare and contrast them fairly recently. So yeah, it's they're quite distinct. But no, Manish, when did you see them?
So the 1940 version I watched, must have been for the first time like 10 or so years ago when I first got into Hitchcock. It was one of the ones I was really excited to watch, and since then it has grown in my estimation considerably, and now I have it, I believe, in like my top 5 or at least top 10 for Hitchcock. It's one of my favorites. I think it's such a beautifully executed gothic romance. Joan Fontaine, I think she's one of the best actors, or she gives two of the best performances in Hitchcock's career, Rebecca in Suspicion, which is the next year, in 1941. And the 2020 version, you know, I was excited about it because I really like Lily James as an actor. And, of course, Armie Hammer is She's great. Kristen Scott Thomas, you know, she's wonderful as well. My only hesitation was Ben Wheatley, because I didn't think he had the sort of the elegance to do a gothic romance. But I watched it over the weekend. We're recording this on Sunday, and I watched it yesterday, Saturday. And I found myself, I found myself taken with it at times and kind of annoyed by it at other times. So excited to get into it with the two of you.
I'll say quickly, because a lot of my enjoyment of film becomes technical and cinematography related, that like originally, you know, just what it is, I watched the old Rebecca on my laptop in black and white, you know, but so that is what it is. And I love black and white films, don't get me wrong, but watching on Netflix on the big HD flat screen TV in this glorious color version and seeing all the detail of the lush scenery and the details of the mansion and those 2000 books on the walls of the den, and all the visuals were very, very impressive. And there are a lot of modern touches I found. Like, this isn't, pardon me for mentioning this film, the Gus Van Sant Psycho, where they did a storyboard for storyboard, right? Where they just lined the two storyboards up and went, ditto, right? So what they're doing here is, there are very many scenes and very many lines in the two films that are same or the similar, but they also will reconstruct scenes. Like, they'll drop locations and use different locations, and they'll add things and take away things. And it's modern in the sense that there are some graphic elements that you see in the new film, like the corpse of Rebecca floating in the water, which is gruesome for 5 seconds, and the actual description of Maxim saying during the tribunal that how could you not identify your wife's corpse? And he says she'd been floating in the water for months and had bloated and disfigured and lost limbs. Like, that wasn't in the original film. That's pretty harsh. Like, that's pretty normal for our tolerances in modern film. But back then, that would have been, whoa, you can't say that. Like, that would have been very outrageous. Comparing the two films in that regard, I found the new film very, the colors and the cinematography and the era was so well done. So what year are we looking at, right? Like, it's not the 2000s. It's kind of 1940s, 1950s, right? But they never dictate what year it was. They kind of give it a bit of limbo for what era this happened in.
No, they never actually say, oh, it's post-war, pre-war. So there's an argument to be made. It could be 30s. It could be 50s. I mean, as much as I love the fashion and the costuming, and you are completely right, it's such a, if nothing else, it's a gorgeous film to look at. The way it's constructed and the colours that are used throughout, it's just absolutely beautiful. I don't know enough about fashion to be able to go, oh yes, that was only popular in the late 1940s or early 50s, or if this is like 1920s and it's sort of post, you know, World War One or that sort of thing. I thought it was interesting when you were talking about the remakes, because another one popped into my head, which is the opposite. So if Rebecca kind of strikes the balance, you've got the Psycho remake, which is following it to a fault. And then if you go and say, look at the Suspiria remake that came out a couple of years ago, which, you know, Luca Guadagnino took the original premise of Suspiria, which is a girl going off to a dance academy and it's a horror, and completely changed it and made it so different, and it's entirely its own thing. To the point where it only shares a vague premise with it. So I think this version of Rebecca is somewhere in between, and I think it is, if nothing else, it's quite a faithful adaptation of the book, which they never would have allowed a lot of the elements in with the Hays Code.
Right.
So there's certain things like, you know, in the book, it's the, oh well, you know, Rebecca goaded Max and he killed her and he is responsible for her death. And that is in the 2020 version. But in the 40s version, it's very much a case of, oh, well, it was all a trick, and she, you know, had cancer, and so it was like a suicide, and she was punished, and it was, you know, it was more restrictive back then. And I think Ben Wheatley does have, the writer, which I believe is Jane, what is her name? I've just forgotten it.
The writer,
Jane Goldman. Yeah, she's written loads of screenplays. I think they were able to kind of adapt it more and be in some ways more faithful to the book. I think the big change for me is the ending, which we can discuss. In terms of comparing them to the 1940 and the 2020 in terms of the acting and everything, I think the big standout for me, and it might be biased because it is a country thing, I would watch Kristen Scott Thomas do Mrs. Danvers for about 6 hours.
Yeah.
Because she's just... It's
horrible.
I almost think she belongs in a different film. Like, she's a bit more camp than everyone else. Like, she's there with sort of a well-manicured eyebrow and a withering put-down, and she's just so... She, I think, is the queerest part of the film. And it's so good. And I love her. And, you know, in the UK, we have such a great affection for her, mainly because people love Four Weddings and a Funeral, but it's, you know, we still absolutely adore her. So even though she's sort of the villain, you do go, oh, God, I love her. She's fab.
She's wonderful at being horrible.
Yeah.
She's so
you're just kind
bad.
Of like, you're an absolute cow, but
everybody,
I love you.
Everybody on the rather large staff of that mansion despise her and fear her.
Right.
Like, she runs it. She just runs that place. Manish, what do you... Can we talk a bit about... Like, this poor lady, this new Mrs. De Winter, and I call her the new Mrs. De Winter because the character does not have a first name. We do not know her name. And she goes from being a young, somewhat orphaned lady servant to getting married to this millionaire and thrown into the biggest shoes, the worst shoes ever for a new wife to have to put on. But what is it about her... It's so amazingly well done that she has no personal identity. Her entire persona is wrapped around the fact that she is not Rebecca, right? Like, how horrible would that be for this young lady to enter that lifestyle?
Yeah, I think for me, I think what this movie is, or what this story in general is, about her, you know, staking a claim to herself, to Manderley, to Maxim, you know, to her role. And I think, you know, she, you know, when she starts the movie as, you know, the companion to that that wealthy woman, she, it's sort of the perfect kind of job for her, where her presence is just that. It's just her being present in a room and, you know, accompanying someone else and kind of just being a, you know, reflecting glass, right? And then, you know, she meets Maxim, and on some level, I think he sees in her a an innocence and a, I think the, like, the blankness that she has. And it's because he was married to Rebecca, who was, you know, this force of personality, force of opinions and, you know, vices and, you know, selfishness, vanity. And that he just, like, he needs someone who is, like, strong enough to shoulder the responsibility of being, you know, the mistress of the house, but also someone who has a genuine love for him and won't get lost in the the pageantry of being, you know, mistress of Manderley. And I think, you know, there's like two ways to look at it, where he just, like, wants some, like, mousy girl that he can control, but I think that's a little uncharitable. I think you know, she's the opposite of Rebecca in every way, but it's also because she has this, inherent, like, spark to her, inherent just, I want to say like innocence, girlishness, where she can, but it's like not that she's childish. I think this is a distinction between childish and girlish, and I think that, like, you know, she steps into this role and she's kind of being forced to be Rebecca in a lot of ways, but the value to her and the reason why she is which is why the reason why Maxim is so in love with her is that she doesn't come with the expectations, the burdens of, you know, of how, like, Rebecca came into the mansion. Like, Rebecca came into the mansion to be lady of the manor, right? And the second Mrs. De Winter came there because she was in love with Maxim. And I think that's the key distinction there is, I think Maxim can be himself around his second wife more than he could be around Rebecca. And I think she brings out in him, you know, a softness, you know, him being loving. And she brings some kind of excitement and joy and, you know, color to the mansion as well.
I'm just thinking quickly here, like, either one of you could talk about this, but Maxim comes from this 300-year heritage of aristocracy that owns mm-hmm. this wonderful estate. Now, when he and Rebecca were the couple and they were running the house and having these gala parties and being the hot socialites, was that... Would Maxim have had that lifestyle without her, or did she bring that? Or was it 50-50 that they just merged and that energy exploded into being how hugely popular they were in the day?
I think Rebecca was interested in playing the role of being that, right? Of carrying on this 300-year-old legacy. But I think his second wife doesn't have that expectation. And, you know, when she meets him and when she, you know, is being courted, you know, at the hotel, like, you can tell that she's not interested in his wealth or his name or anything. I think she's drawn to him on a different level. And I think he sees in her someone that will see him for himself, not, you know, the heir to Mandalay like Rebecca did. So I feel like he did all that stuff with Rebecca because he had to, but I don't see him feeling that obligation with his second wife.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, I think there is a moment in the film where, because it's her idea, well, not her idea, you know, Danvers puts it in her head of, you know, having the costume ball and having all, you know, that big social thing, and he initially isn't that fussed. He's not like, oh yeah, it's so important, you must attend to the duties and must do all that sort of thing. So yeah, I think she was interested in filling a very specific role and being sort of a, not a socialite, but being a very social presence and, you know, fulfilling certain roles and obligations and that sort of thing. And it is interesting, the whole film is essentially about kind of power dynamics. So you have Maxim, who takes on this sort of guileless, not exactly naive because she has seen the world, but like you said, she's quite fresh. She has no expectations of Max or Mandalay, and she doesn't really care. She just likes him. She's not in for the title. She's not in for anything. And it's interesting that he kind of not dominates her, but he does kind of say, oh, well, we're going to do this, or, you know, oh, we'll get married, or that sort of thing. And then at the end, as she asserts power, she doesn't get a name. She's still only Mrs. De Winter, but she does get agency. You know, she's the one who breaks into the doctor's office, even though technical, it's a bit of a plot hole, but it literally makes no difference that she does that, but it's still nice. And she's the one who's kind of helping him and taking control and that sort of thing. So it is interesting. For me, the thing that, I mean, apart from, I think some of the performances in the 2021 are great. I don't mind Arnie Hammer, but he never does anything for me in particular. He's very pretty to look at. And he fills that mustard-coloured suit very well.
I remember that suit. Like, I was looking at that suit going, damn, that's a good-looking suit.
Well, I mean, ironically, like when I moved into my flat, it's the sofa, which I'm currently sat on, is that exact colour. So I was looking at it going, oh my God, okay.
I'll just say that no matter what colour suit I wear at the beginning of the day with my eating habits, it ends up mustard-coloured by the end of the day.
Well, I mean, that's an image, Tom. Thank you.
There you go.
But no, like, I love... It's weird. Anne Dowd seems like the nicest person in the world, but she's so good at playing horrible people. Like, when she plays Mrs... I've completely forgotten her name, but she plays the Mrs. De Winter's sort of... the person she's a paid companion for in the first sort of third of the film.
Oh, yeah.
Before they actually head off to Mandalay, and she's awful, and I love her. But I think the thing that was I don't know how you feel about this, and I'll be interested. Compared to the 40s version, and if you know anything about the book, what were your opinions on the ending? Because it's quite different to... It's its own distinct ending.
Now, we'll just, you know, throw up the yellow flag and warn that there'll probably be some spoilers here, which normally on our show isn't an issue, as Chris likes to say, you've had 55 years to watch the movie. But as we are dealing with a film which is currently in popular release, fair warning, if you're sensitive to spoilers, you might want to go do something else. And Manish, your thoughts on the two endings?
So the 1940 film is very faithful to the novel. I remember reading that I didn't read the book. I listened to the audiobook. But I remember, reading that David O. Selznick, who was the producer, insisted that everything had to be, faithful to the novel because he said audiences wouldn't accept a movie that deviated too much. They wanted to see the book on screen. But the only thing that Hitchcock had to change was the ending, and because of the Hays Code, which we talked about. And I think it's hard for me to criticize the ending of the 1940 movie or to talk about it in that regard, just because I know that, like, I don't think anyone involved in the project really liked how it ended, because it just seems a little too contrived. Whereas in the novel and in this version, the ending, this, it just makes more sense. It's a little bit more natural, or a little bit more organic, I mean. I think it's really fascinating to see the novel's ending, or at least like closer to that ending in this film version, because the ending is like the one part that I feel is a little bit like superior to the original, to the older film, just because it feels more in tune with like the themes and the narrative that Daphne du Maurier was going for in her novel. And it's like really, really underscores how much, you know, the studios were under control back then. They were controlled by the Hays Code, because like that ending, I mean, honestly, for me, like, as much as I love Rebecca, that last half hour, just like, I kind of lose interest, and I love all the stuff before, you know, the confession, and I think it's exquisite, but I think Hitchcock kind of, I think I felt this way about the novel as well. So it feels like it loses its protagonist. You know, Joan Fontaine and Lily James, like, to me, like, those are the people who are tying me to the book, or tying me to the story. And so when it goes into the whole, like, trial, and it focuses on Maxim and all that, and Favel gets involved and whatever. I just feel like, you know, I think this might just be an inherent flaw in the source novel, where it's just that, like, the most alluring part of the book to me gets lost. And I was hoping that this 2020 version would improve on that, but I really don't think it does in any more significant way. I think, you know, I think it's just how the story goes. I guess I don't really know. I wouldn't really know how to fix that problem. I think without kind of redoing the entire last act of it. But so I enjoyed the ending this time around more so than the 1940 version, but I still think that there's an inherent issue there where it's just like, it just completely changes the protagonist of the story. And you lose so much of what makes the story so powerful, which is the dynamic between, you know, the second wife, Rebecca's ghost, and Mrs. Danvers.
Hmm. Tom, what did you think about the ending?
Just a quick thought that I did remark to myself. I said self. The ending of the 40s version, the special effects, as it were, or the modeling that they went through to do the burning down of the mansion was pretty well done. It looked pretty convincing. And I'm guessing they did like a scale model and were burning it in like a rear projection or something. But quite honestly, right now, off the top of my head, I don't really have a good sense of the difference between the two endings.
Okay.
Chris, did you have a preference between either version?
So I've got sort of complicated feelings. So if you compare like the book, the 40s version, and the 2020 version, they're all slightly different. I don't prefer one over the other. The 2020 version has elements in it that I enjoy a lot, and then there's some bits which it's weird. So the main difference is, so in the 2020 version, again, spoiling it if you've not seen it, so Danvers sets fire to Mandalay. They go try and put it out, but rather than Danvers being inside and she's burning up with Rebecca's bedroom, Lily James sees her heading to the coast to where Rebecca died. She runs down, they have a final sort of cliffside confrontation, and she curses Lily James and says, "You will never be happy," and then kills herself by throwing herself into the sea. Which, I'll be honest, I liked it. I thought, okay, she literally wants to go be with Rebecca, and I'm like, cool, all that sort of thing. I am someone who really loves happy endings. I am that cliche, I love it when the good guys win, I love it when the heroes survive a horror movie or an action movie or whatever. I am that person. I will root for a happy ending no matter what. For me, the final minute or so, which is basically, it's only hinted at in the novel, and it's not in the 40s version, but where you see Max and second Mrs. De Winter, and they are living abroad somewhere, and it's supposed to be like they're free from their ghosts, and it ends with them basically kissing in some kind of warm country, judging by all the sunlight in that last scene. I think it's very sweet, but for me, I don't know if it matches the tone of the rest of the film, because it sort of implies, rightly or wrongly, that, oh, okay, now that your ancestral home has been burnt to the ground, that's your, you know, your connection severed, and, you know, oh, you can be free and you can be the person that you want to be, which may or may not be the case, but it doesn't, for me, it doesn't match up with who, with what Max's kind of main issue is. His main issue is his sort of grief and guilt over causing his first wife's death. And ideally that'd be resolved as soon as it's like, oh, well, you didn't actually kill her, the cancer did, and it was like a cyclical moment or that sort of thing. I agree with what Manish was saying in terms of the most important relationship running throughout is between, it's that sort of relationship triangle between Rebecca, the second Mrs. De Winter, and Mrs. Danvers, because it's this sort of, it's this dark, twisted relationship that in a way, Max, unfortunately, he's not even really a strong character throughout, in the sense of, you know, his motivations are really secondary to this kind of complex power dynamic and play that's going on. So I enjoyed the fact that we had that final scene with Danvers and Mrs. De Winter on the coast, and I thought that was great, and I really enjoyed that. I didn't like it. It felt quite tacked on the last 2 minutes for me personally. If other people enjoyed it, I really commend it, and good for them. Do I prefer one ending over the other? I don't. I like, as cheesy as it is, I do like the kind of the high camp drama of Danvers being in the fire and she burns up and the camera pans and it's on the big R and it's supposed to be a big R in the sky with the smoke, and I'm like, okay, cool, I get that. That's fun in a way. The 2020s one is satisfying because we get actual closure for the characters, and I'm like, okay, that's fine, that's cool. And in the book version, it's somewhere in between, where you know from the bat that the heroine has survived because she's narrated the story. But it literally ends with, oh, we saw smoke rising from Manderley. So each of the film versions has expanded upon the final beat of the book in a way. And you guys may be right in the sense of maybe it's something to do with the source material that doesn't... It works better in a book sense than it does translate into film. In the same way, we'll look at this down the line, but if you look at the original Du Maurier short story for The Birds, there are certain things in the book that cannot translate to film, and there are certain things in the film that wouldn't work in a book context. So maybe it's like an incompatibility of mediums, maybe. But for the 2021, I was never not entertained by it, and I'll be honest, the hunting dogs that Rebecca has is the same breed of dog as mine, so I immediately was in favour of it. I was like, oh, cute dogs. Already thumbs up.
I think we can agree to refer to this genre as a romantic mystery, especially the new one. And one of my coworkers, Tashina, we were talking about the film, which she had already seen, and her point of view was, she wanted a horror film with ghosts and scary, like dark. So if you guys
wanted Crimson Peak,
So if you guys could do a rewrite of the modern version, would you ever consider making taking the last hour and having Rebecca throwing lamps around the mansion, or like really really upping the scare factor?
For me, I personally wouldn't mind it if. This sounds so awful. I wouldn't mind it if Max died, to be honest. I wouldn't.
How would he die?
If it came down like, in my head, I was partially like, what if he gets possessed by the ghost, or if there's some kind of dark thing, and it's like her and Danvers and the spirit of Rebecca, and the second Mrs. De Winter's the only one to sort of escape, and she kind of claims her identity back then. And it's all about how she, you know, as a survivor and that sort of thing. But I don't know. I've not read enough gothic fiction.
I think for me, it would be fun to watch that and to write that. but I think it wouldn't be Rebecca. It wouldn't be like the Rebecca. It would just be a ghost story. Because I think the power of this movie is the psychological element of it, is that Rebecca isn't a ghost in the sense that she's not haunting things physically, but she is a ghost in the sense that her presence is just like suffocating everyone in the house. And to me, which is, I think this is why I prefer of course I prefer the 1940 version, but I think the reason why that one speaks to me more than this one, the new one does, is because I think Hitchcock is really emphasizing the suspense, like how suspenseful and how thrilling and how horror, like how much of a horror movie it can be, like when there's no supernatural element to it and it's just suggestion, it's all psychological, it's all manipulation. And I think the 2020 version for me misses that suspense element. Romantic mystery is kind of a perfect way to describe it. And you know, as as a movie that's an adaptation of a book, I think it's successful. But you know, to have a version that is so psychologically tuned to the character's sort of interior, you know, neuroses or whatever, and by, you know, Hitchcock, you know, bringing that all that into the visual part of it, you know, with the shadows and the art direction and the cinematography, the score, the performances, you know, to me, like, I think I have to separate the two movies as one being, you know, a pure gothic, suspenseful romance movie, another one just being a, you know, domestic romantic mystery film that is, it just doesn't have that, like, it just doesn't take to that extra level of, you know, suspense that Hitchcock has. And so I would love to see, you know, Rebecca's ghost throwing stuff around and possessing people. That'd be really fun, I think. And, you know, like a Bly Manor, you know, kind of thing, or Crimson Peak, as you mentioned, like, that would be so much fun. And, you know, if the people who do Bly Manor want to do Rebecca and turn it into that, I'd be so into it. But it just wouldn't have the same, it wouldn't have the same pull for me. It would just be, I would just have to make it be totally separate.
So, Manish, yeah. Manish, you're preferring the 1940 film?
Yeah.
Of these two? Sorry, go ahead, Chris.
No, I was going to say, so it's almost a bit like the, when I mentioned Suspiria, if you compare the 74 to the 2018, it's basically, oh, it's the same initial premise, but it takes it in such different directions.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's not the same thing, and they can't, comparing them is like comparing chalk and cheese, so yeah, I agree.
So Chris, you're, which, pick one of these two to recommend.
It's still going to have to be the 40s version for me. Like, I think Ben Wheatley did a solid job, and it's not anything I would think is really in his oeuvre, because he writes thrillers and he does action, but to do something like this, I think, was an interesting choice, and I've got to commend him for stepping outside of his kind of comfort zone a bit. But for me, it's the 40s version. It's always going to be the 40s version.
I would pick the 40s version also, just because it's an epicer film. It's a bigger film.
Yes.
Right? It's Gone with the Wind. Like, it is a big film. But don't get me wrong, I love this 2020. This is great. This is very positive for the fandom of Hitchcock. Like, this is a very big development. Like, we talked a lot about on our show over the episodes. We've talked about how a lot of the films are very modern, and we want people to get involved with them. We don't want them to be afraid of movies from the 30s and 40s and 50s. And I think that's what this type of film will achieve, is bringing the new fans into the fold of loving Hitchcock, right?
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, the biggest thing I could say in its favour is, so my family don't like, I'm the only one who really watches vintage movies, or movies that are kind of earlier than, say, the 60s or the 50s or whatever. So I would say, and in fact I'm going to try and get them to do this, is, you know, they have Netflix. I pay for it, so they definitely have it. I would use this as an example of, okay, here is an example of an adaptation that it does work on its own. Even though we've picked the 40s version, I think, you know, it's an okay film. It's not a bad film. You will enjoy it. But it can be a useful way of, okay, here's the story of Rebecca in a more modern format for people who don't like black and white films, or who don't like films from the 40s or whatever. So, like, this is one that I could get my mum to watch, or my dad to watch, or my brother to watch. Because it's a very glossy, enjoyable thriller with some fantastic performances.
For sure.
And it's visually stunning. So I would say, if you're struggling to get people to watch older films, some of these new adaptations, they're not all perfect, but some of them can be really good at kind of starting to bridge the gap.
Manish, any final comments?
You know what? I think my last thing that I wanted to bring up is, I wish this new version was a little sexier. I don't just mean like sex scenes, but I just mean, like, I didn't find much heat in it, and I wouldn't say it felt passionless, but it just didn't feel like I don't know. I wish there was a little bit more like a steaminess or a little bit more of that, like, you know, visceral kind of thing to it. Because it felt a little distanced for me in terms of the romance and the passion. But that's my main thing. Because I mean, I think that, you know, with two actors who look like the ones that, you know, we have, you know, Armie Hammer, Lily Hammer, I just didn't feel much chemistry there. But I also recognize that I don't think this was that kind of movie. I don't know. I think I may have just been a little off base with what I was expecting from someone like Ben Wheatley, who I don't think is a very sexy director.
No. They've never, Ben Wheatley has never been like, oh yeah, he's like Brian De Palma.
Right.
Doing like erotic thriller or anything. But no, I agree. Lily James is fantastic. Arnie Hammer's great, but they don't have a lot of chemistry and they both seem really nice and they seem to have got on and all that sort of thing, but sometimes it just doesn't translate into great on screen chemistry.
Right on.
Yeah, if they're listening, please, we do like you. Come on the show.
My Cinderella.
But
that's great, guys. Yeah. Thank you all. Thanks everybody for listening in as we discuss these two films. Thank you, Manish. It's been great having you. You bring a really great perspective to the show. And thanks, Chris, for... Chris was like, hey, guys, let's do the Rebeccas. Let's have Manish. Like, this is sort of Chris's idea.
I was going to say, if you hated this episode, it's my fault, so don't worry. It's fine. We'll be back to normal stuff soon. But when I watched it last month, I was like, oh, we have to do a compare.
Yeah,
because it's rare that we get like an adaptation on at the same time as we're doing a thing. So I was like, let's do it.
Yeah, no, thanks again for having me. I had such a great time chatting with you guys. I love being on your show, and great job on reaching 50 episodes. You guys, I'm always so amazed that you guys pulled through with the silent era, and now you're getting to all the fun stuff.
Yeah, so, we're getting that's the payoff, right? So yeah. Manish, what would you tell our viewers? Where do you want them to follow you or look for you online?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at TheManish89. That's TheManish89. Also, my two podcasts, It Pod to Be You and Queer Now, which you can find on any podcasting app that you use, and they're both on Twitter as well. So look for us there. Thanks.
And Chris, your social media, have you got any big projects we don't know about?
No. Anyway, you might have like, just like, no, there's nothing going on. I'll be honest, we're in a pandemic. So you can find me on Twitter at @hire_boy. Come and say hi. You'll probably find me on there just talking nonsense. But it'll be very nice to chat to you. If you've got a different perspective on Rebecca and you think I'm completely wrong, please tell me. Come and say hi.
So, thank you, guys. I am on the Twitter as TomCaldwell3000. And, again, like, we really appreciate anything you can do to follow us on Facebook or Twitter or share our posts or circulate the promotion of our show. We always appreciate any comments, any feedback. So make sure, like we were saying earlier in the show today, to check out robertzavala.net for the Psycho Swamp poster, and listen to the beginning of our show for instructions on how to enter the contest. You can win yourself a copy of the poster. The Camera Lies, Acting for Hitchcock, the brand new book by Dan Callahan, Oxford University Press. Highly recommended. And again, thank you to Manish. Thank you, Annie and Catherine, our sister podcast. Their show is called Good Evening in Alfred Hitchcock Presents Podcast. And check them out when you can. Thank you, Jason Cullimore. Guys, how awesome is our theme music? Anytime I have a chance to play it on big speakers, I'm just like, oh, that sounds so cool. Jason did an amazing theme song for us. And Kyle and Kevin at Fandom Podcast Network have been very patient. They've given us a bit of training on how to get into their YouTube feed. So we've posted a video. We're going to start trying to do some video content. We're trying to do stuff that is bonus outside of the podcast. So something a bit more, you know, specialized than just the podcast itself. So keep an eye on the Fandom Podcast Network channel on YouTube. And thank you, Brandon Shea Mutala, our founding producer, for thinking this whole thing up 50 episodes ago in 2017. He approached Chris and I and talked us into this. So we're having a hell of a good time. And thank you to all our listeners and all our special guests and all the different people that have supported us over these 3 years. And as we like to do at the end of our show, I wish you good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.